Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The $36 billion Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is one of the biggest philanthropic institutions in the world. The foundation has poured billions of dollars into health, agriculture, and educational initiatives. Domestically, Bill Gates, co-chair of the foundation, has called education his biggest priority. According to the Chronicle of Higher Education, since 2006, the Gates Foundation has spent $472 million on education reform. So how is this money affecting the current debate about education in the U.S.? How is it spent? And who's actually making the policies behind this money? When it comes to education reform, what is the Gates Foundation's overall goals? Today, we are joined by three reporters and writers who've been involved in extensive investigations about the Gates Foundation. Charles Piller is an investigative reporter with the Sacramento Bee. He was the lead reporter in a 2007 investigative series about the Gates Foundation's investment practices, and he joins us from Oakland. Hi, Charles. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much, Rose.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Jennifer Ruark. She's deputy managing editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education, and she was involved in an extensive package of stories about the Gates Foundation. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you.
And Anthony Cody spent 24 years working in Oakland schools, 18 of them as a science teacher at a high-needs school. Anthony is a treasurer of the Network for Public Education, and he also writes the Living in Dialogue blog on Education Week's website. After writing an extensive piece on the foundation, Anthony had a lengthy public dialogue with representatives from the foundation. And Anthony joins us from Mendocino. Hi, Anthony. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Nice to have you. So, Charles, I want to start off with you because you were the lead reporter in a 2007 investigative series about the foundation. How long has the foundation been involved in education issues?
Well, they've been involved in education issues for many years, really since their inception. And the Bill Gates has always had this as one of his priorities, along with the what have been up till now the greatest priorities, global health and development.
And so Bill Gates has said that education is his biggest priority. How much focus are they spending on education?
That's not really reflected in their spending so far. I mean, I think there's different ways to measure what your highest priority is, perhaps, than just sheer funds. But the Gates Foundation breaks down their grants into those three areas, global health, global development, and U.S. programs, which is mostly education programs. They also have a small amount of money, I think it's notable, for media grants, and these are what they call strategic media partnerships, including a fairly large sum of money to NPR, which I'm sure many of your listeners have heard on the broadcast day after day, thanking the Gates Foundation. That's notable, I think, because as I'm sure the other reporters on this show could attest, there tends to be a bit of paucity of skepticism towards the Gates Foundation's programs. I don't think it's necessarily directly because they fund so much media work, but I think it's worth asking the question about things like that. This is such an amazingly clever and generous entity, one that has done so much good in the world, that I think sometimes what happens is they get a pass in regard to critical reporting.
Well, and Jennifer, the piece that your team did at the Chronicle of Higher Education called this an echo chamber because the foundation funds other foundations, think tanks, researchers, and the media. So do you agree with Charles? Do you think they sometimes get a pass on issues like education because of all the money that they give out?
I do think so. First of all, I should disclose that the Chronicle has also received, not in the form of grants, but in the form of contracts, $850,000 from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to support work that we've done on two standalone websites that are related to college completion and helping students and parents make more informed choices about their financial commitment to colleges. So I think in a way it's even more incumbent upon the Chronicle and has been more incumbent upon the Chronicle to ask tough questions about the Gates Foundation. And I would agree that part of this sort of echo chamber is created by the kinds of stories that news outlets are doing, but I think it's really larger than that. A lot of the money that Gates spends on higher education reform, and by the way, that $472 million figure is higher education reform. It doesn't even count most of the K-12 support. is going to think tanks and other foundations with really a very similar education agenda.
Were reporters at the Chronicle concerned when the Chronicle decided to take $850,000 from the foundation?
There were some conversations among the staff.
Now, you said $472 million on higher education. How much on K through 12?
I don't actually know the K through 12 figure, and that $472 million does include some early college programs, which are run out of high schools. But maybe Anthony or Charles has that number.
Anthony, do you know?
I'm not sure the exact number. I think it's over a billion, though.
Over a billion on K through 12?
Yes, in the last decade.
And so you've done extensive reporting. You actually had a lengthy public dialogue with representatives from the foundation because of your reporting. What strikes you the most about the foundation and its goals for education?
Well, the Gates Foundation has a very clear agenda for K-12 and higher education, which is to really turn it into a marketplace. And to that end, they promote a lot of emphasis on the measurement of quantifiable outputs, and they use test scores as the means of doing that. The reason that is important is that if you want a marketplace in education, you have to have some basis upon which to create essentially bankruptcy. In the normal marketplace, you have profit and loss, and if you lose money, you go bankrupt. In the schools, they want to create a similar phenomenon which would allow the breaking of the public school monopoly, and that opens up the market for other private and, you know, charter schools and other educational delivery systems that they see as being potentially more efficient and more innovative.
We spoke about this last week with Diane Ravitch, who has a new book out about the privatization of education. Can you point us to some clear examples that prove what you just said?
Sure. The Gates Foundation has heavily promoted the Common Core standards, and the whole purpose of the Common Core standards is to create a common operating system for all schools. To allow comparison between schools from state to state, have tests that are used then to prove failure. Essentially, the Common Core tests that are coming along are resulting in tremendous drops in student proficiency. In New York State, only 31% of the students passed the Common Core test, and the governor there immediately turned around and called for a death penalty for failing schools. Meanwhile, the Gates Foundation has been heavily promoting the expansion of charter schools across the country basically paying districts to enter into something called the Gates Compact, which says that they will treat charter schools with the same deference that they do their own public schools. And this is resulting in some places in a tremendous expansion of charter schools. Charter schools tend to have fewer, much less union representation among teachers, and they also are selective. Some of them are quite selective with their student population, and so we end up having this dual system, which is what this market-based system produces, is you have privately operated schools that take the students that are most profitable, most easy to educate, and leave the disabled students, the English language learners, the more difficult to educate students for a sort of a residual public school system, which they can then continue to discredit as being a failure.
According to Patch, last December the foundation donated $25 million to seven cities to support charter expansion. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, they've been very, very aggressively supporting the expansion of charter schools across the country.
And Charles, I mean, there's a larger question here. Why is the Gates Foundation so interested in education in the first place?
Well, frankly, education is not the area that I've covered heavily in my reporting. I've covered more global health and development and issues related to their investment portfolio and how consistently that portfolio is applied to the foundation's philanthropic goals. So I can't really answer the genesis of their interest in education.
Well, I mean, as a reporter who covers this, do you think that these issues get enough attention in the media because they do have so much influence? And according to the Chronicle of Higher Education package, it's not like they're just giving the money away. I mean, they're involved throughout the whole process, right?
Well, I think one thing that can be said that's important that applies to all of the Gates Foundation programs is that it's important for people to remember that this gigantic foundation, which includes both the assets of Bill and Melinda Gates and also of Warren Buffett, and probably will end up giving away more than $100 billion in its entire existence, which is scheduled to end 50 years after the death of the founders. It's important to remember that it exists because the tax code makes it possible. Most of this fortune would otherwise go to the common good in other ways, for better or worse, controlled by the democratic process through tax revenues and their spending by our elected representatives. So in effect, I think some of the issues that the other guests have suggested, entrusting these business titans to make the smartest, best decisions for how their great influence is used in education or in other ways, essentially concentrates the control over these vital social issues into relatively few hands. Mm. Admittedly, in this case, these are very thoughtful people who are smart, they learn from mistakes, and they often do enormous good in the world. But it raises a big question about people who are interested in education policy, about whether that concentration into so few hands for the vast influence that the Gates Foundation has beyond the number of dollars it spends, but by funding other entities and by the great respect that it's held, that the community holds it in. That is something that I think people need to examine and think through.
And do you, I mean, based on your reporting, are people comfortable questioning the foundation and the policies it embraces, especially those who think maybe down the road I might get some of that money?
Well, I think it's the same issue you see with other very, very powerful entities, but magnified because of the scope and the incredible size of this foundation. You're talking about an entity that spends in every year more than the next largest foundations in the world have as their complete assets. In other words, $3.3 billion spent in the last year by the Gates Foundation overall is more than other giant foundations have in their entire portfolio to spend over many years. And consequently, the power, the influence that they have, sometimes for better, sometimes for worse, is enormous. And it has an influence that's way beyond the dollars. It steers often the programs of whole nation states with regard to their policies on things like global health.
And then, based on what you found in your reporting, how involved are they in the process? So, for example, a couple decades ago, you might have the Ford Foundation giving a grant, and that's it, they're done. But how involved is the foundation once, what happens after they give the money away?
Well, I mean, I think, again, it's a mixed bag. The Gates Foundation is a thoughtful entity that studies its experience and tries to do course corrections, particularly in the global health realm. They have research to examine how effective their grants have been. I think that one of the problems, though, you see is that any large institution like this will have biases and will have shortcomings based on its inability to see all the features of a problem. And even though these are incredibly smart and thoughtful people, they do have areas where they've unfortunately have failed to address some of the key contradictions in their strategy. So let me just give you an example from my reporting that I think is critical to understanding how this vast institution functions in our society. So you're talking about a portfolio of about nearly $40 billion that's invested in corporations all over the world and in other financial entities. And these investments often are in corporations whose actions in the world run completely counter to the Gates Foundation's philanthropic goals. So in other words, because of the vast power of the investments themselves, which are not addressed by the foundation as a means for bringing about positive change in the world, they sometimes have a deleterious effect on the great work that they're doing in things like global health. And as a result, that's the kind of contradiction, I think, that is a blind spot for the foundation that they've refused to look at more carefully. Now since my investigation a few years ago, they have done a few things. They've divested, for example, from their Sudan-related holdings because of the human rights violations in Sudan. Mm-hmm. And they've done a few very, very small changes in their portfolio. But overall, they remain dedicated to the idea that they can't have any influence in that realm because they're just investors. And I think that's an area that many people have said is a short-sighted look. And I think that sort of lack of seeing all the sides of the picture is something that is probably endemic to concentrating power in so few hands in almost any realm.
And before we let you go, Charles, can you give us an example of one of the contradictions you found?
Yeah, for example, we looked very carefully at health issues in sub-Saharan Africa. That was one of the big areas that we focused on. And what we found was that even though many of the programs were doing excellent work, for example, in providing vaccination services and in other kinds of health services, in the very same communities that the foundation was providing these life-saving services, they were also huge investors in some of the worst polluters in Africa, companies whose degradation of local environments were causing a great deal of health problems and sometimes even eclipsing the health problems and the health gains that the foundation was trying to overcome with its philanthropic giving.
Well, Charles, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Rose.
Thank you. That's Charles Piller. He's an investigative reporter with the Sacramento Bee. And in 2007, he was the lead reporter in an investigative series about the Gates Foundation's investment practices. And you can find his piece and the other pieces we're talking about today at yourcallradio.org. And staying with us for the rest of the hour is Jennifer Ruark. She's deputy managing editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education. And Anthony Cody, he writes the Living in Dialogue blog on Education Week's website. And today we are talking about the $36 billion Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It's one of the biggest philanthropic institutions in the world. We're specifically focusing on education. Since 2006, the foundation has spent $472 million on higher education reform and over $1 billion on K-12 education. So what questions do you have about the Gates Foundation and how it spends its money? And if you work in the field of education, how has this foundation affected education and education policies? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. So, Jennifer, Charles was talking about some of the contradictions he found in his reporting. What contradictions have you found in how the Gates Foundation deals with education, or have you found any?
Well, that's a great question, and it goes back to your earlier question about why the Gates Foundation is interested in higher education reform to begin with. And the answer to that question is that they were looking for ways that they might have an effect on poverty rates in the United States, and decided that the biggest barrier to people rising up into the middle class was a lack of a post-secondary credential. So they came up with this program to try to graduate more students, graduate them more quickly, and graduate them for less money. Now, this wasn't their original idea, but they've been instrumental in making it dominant in conversations about higher education. And your callers might well, or listeners might well wonder, you know, what's so wrong with that? Getting more people college degrees must be a good thing. What the critics are concerned about is that the Gates Foundation's narrow focus on job preparation and getting people a credential that will help them in the job market really seems to turn education into a private benefit rather than a public good. And so critics say that it may be giving states an excuse to slack off in investing and supporting higher education. And as you know, state support for higher education has plummeted over the last several years. If you go back even further, in 1987, about three-quarters of the funds that public colleges spent on education came from state support, and the rest came from tuition. over time that number has dropped so that it's closer to 50-50, and in some cases, like California, less than half of the support is coming from the state. So that's one concern that people have, and the contradiction that they see in the Gates Foundation's agenda is that with this emphasis on getting through fast and sort of vocational-oriented training, there's a fear that the programs that result from it may track poor and underprepared students into a very narrow education, while wealthier students get the broader education that's not focused strictly on job credentials.
So how has this program played out? Can you give us any examples?
Yeah, well, probably the biggest influence so far in terms of policy has been at the state level. If you looked 4 years ago at states that tried to tie their support for colleges to the college's graduation rates, there were about three. Now there are some 26 states that are either already tying support to colleges' so-called performance or considering it. At least 26 that are in the process of implementing that or have already, and then more than that, which are considering it. They've also, many states have pressured colleges to drop remedial education because there is some research out there that says that students in remedial classes get stuck there and that their graduation rates are very poor. That's through organizations like Jobs for the Future and what's the other one? I'm blanking on it right now.
That's okay.
But basically Jobs for the Future is supported with Gates Foundation money and the Complete College America, that's the other one I was thinking of. And Jobs for the Future and Complete College America have been making the rounds, talking to state legislatures, showing them the research that they have, and encouraging them to implement these kinds of policies.
Well, we have to take a break in a couple minutes, but let's take a caller before we do that. Let's hear from Sandra in San Bruno. Hi, Sandra. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for taking my call, and thank you so much to you and your guests for shedding light on this really important issue. I am a mother in the South San Francisco Unified School District. I have a son who's in first grade, and I just want to comment on how for our open house night at the beginning of this year, we were sold on this core curriculum idea of how it was going to promote critical thinking, creative thinking, how it was going to be so much better for our children. And when I have conversations with parents about this and I inform them on how this core curriculum is being funded and in what direction it's going, basically I agree with you about the privatization of public education. It's really concerning for me that no one believes me in how it's being funded. And how can a parent struggling to inform other parents get through to them in thinking critically about this core curriculum issue when we're being sold a bill of goods by our principals and by our superintendents?
Well, you know, stay on the line, Sandra, because I'd love to find out what other parents think about CORE. And then I'll get both of our guests to respond and then also just to briefly explain CORE for those who aren't familiar with it. Today, we are talking about education and specifically the Gates Foundation and its influence on how money is spent and how policy is made. Since 2006, the foundation has spent $472 million on higher education reform and $1 billion on K-12 education reform. What questions do you have about the Gates Foundation, where the money goes, if you're a parent or an educator? What are your thoughts on all of this, about how this money is affecting education? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
Local Public Radio KALW, if you want to add a perspective that you've not yet heard in today's program, or a question you feel needs to be answered, please get in touch by calling 866-798-TALK. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a question on the website. Again, that's at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about influential people and corporations in San Francisco. Today, the city is defined by its growing number of tech companies, but the city is also home to major financial institutions and developers. So how do they influence the political and cultural landscape of San Francisco? And who's making the most important decisions about issues like development and the economy? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the $36 billion Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Warren Buffett is also a major player. It's one of the biggest philanthropic institutions in the world. They're pouring billions into health, agricultural, and educational initiatives. Today, we're specifically talking about education. Bill Gates has called education his biggest priority. Since 2006, the foundation has spent $472 million on higher education reform and over $1 billion on K-12 education reform. And if you have any questions or comments about how the money is spent, we'd love to hear from you. If you work in education, if you're connected to education, what changes have you seen as a result of this foundation money? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Jennifer Ruark. She's deputy managing editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education. You can find their package of stories at yourcallradio.org. And Anthony Cody spent 24 years working in Oakland schools. He writes the Living in Dialogue blog on Education Week's website. After writing a lengthy piece on the foundation, he had a public dialogue with representatives there. And Anthony, before you tackle Sandra's question, can you just give us a quick overview of the Common Core program?
Sure. Folks are probably familiar with No Child Left Behind, which George W. Bush brought in with the help of Democratic support from people like George Miller in Contra Costa County. No Child Left Behind made school accountability revolve around test scores. And over the last 12 years, it's become hugely unpopular because it forced schools to teach to the test. So as that bill, that law was getting ready to sunset, they had to come up with something new, some new form of accountability. And that's where the Common Core came in. The Department of Education is prevented by statute from writing national standards. So the Gates Foundation got involved and created this process by which funded organizations that it funded, like the National Governors Association and the State School Officers Organization, they got together and they created the Common Core standards, with very little involvement from K-12 educators and a lot of involvement from test makers. So the Common Core standards are really built to enable a common set of tests, because one of the problems with No Child Left Behind was that each state was allowed to have its own system of tests and setting proficiency levels. So if you want to have a national accountability regimen, you cannot have that. So the Common Core allows for state-to-state comparisons, it allows for school-to-school comparisons, and it allows for teacher-to-teacher comparisons. And so the Department of Education has been heavily pushing, with a lot of support from the Gates Foundation, the idea that teachers should be evaluated based on test scores, not only schools, but teachers. And I wanted to talk a little bit about this think tank idea, because some of the guests have alluded to the reports that come out. There's sort of this cycle. The Gates Foundation is funding think tanks which do research on these various social issues, like how to get more people into college or how to boost test scores and so on. They release these institutes, then go and testify to state legislatures as if they're objective experts, and I'm talking about things like the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. The Gates Foundation paid them to evaluate the Common Core standards. Well, the Gates Foundation is hardly an impartial source on the Common Core standards. Then they also fund groups, citizens groups or teachers groups that will support their policies. So a group like Teach Plus or Educators for Excellence. They will provide millions of dollars to these groups, and then these groups will train teachers to go and testify at the state legislature in favor of laws that require their pay and their evaluations to be based on test scores. So there's sort of a whole, the amount of money, it's not just the amount of money, but it's the way that the money is spent in sort of all these different strategic ways to orchestrate what looks like public support, what looks like bipartisan expert support, and in actuality, it's all coming from this same source and this same ideology that is promoting test scores as the as a measure of learning and markets as the means of improving schools.
What would you say to a parent like Sandra who wants to talk to other parents about these issues? I mean, how does she get her hands on this information, and how does she even begin to understand what this means for her child?
Well, there are a lot of grassroots activists out there who are getting involved in this issue. You mentioned Diane Ravitch. Her new book, Reign of Error, is a fantastic resource on all this. It's really a textbook on understanding all this. And she's going to be speaking at Stanford next Monday. She's going to be at Berkeley on Saturday. She's going to be at Sacramento this coming Thursday. So if people can go here, that would be great. If people can go pick up her book. I started a group called Network for Public Education, which Diane Ravitch is the president of, and we are doing our best to try to educate people about this, and you can find us on the web. And there are a lot of other activists, grassroots activist groups, also involved in this.
And we interviewed Diane on Thursday, and you can find that online at yourcallradio.org. Thank you again for calling, Sandra. Sandra had to jump off the line. Before we get to our next caller, I just wanted to ask you, Jennifer, can you talk a little bit about how the Gates Foundation also interacts with politicians? How much influence do they have over policy?
Sure. Well, there is a kind of Washington, D.C., you, I think, referred to it earlier as an echo chamber, where people who have worked for the Education Department or the Gates Foundation or Jobs for the Future or the National Governors Association or the New America Foundation, which is a big funder of education policy research, have, you know, traveled back and forth among those institutions. So usually, you know, there are ethics rules that prevent someone who has worked for the government to work on, who has worked for an organization and then goes to the government to work on policy that it would affect that organization. But there is an exception that can be made to that for research that's or policy that's done in the broad public interest. And a couple of people now at the Ed Department have been given that kind of waiver to work on such projects.
And that is Jennifer Ruark. She's deputy managing editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education. And Anthony Cody writes the Living in Dialogue blog on Education Week's website. After writing an extensive piece on the foundation, he had a lengthy public dialogue with representatives from the foundation. We've got full lines, so let's go to our next caller, Evie in Berkeley.
Hi,
Evie.
I'm a 35-year retired teacher and a reading specialist in the Berkeley schools, actually, is my credential. And I started teaching in 65 when we had Head Start, Follow Through. No Child Left Behind came along. And then Arne Duncombe came up with Race to the Top. That didn't sell. So now we've got Common Core. I guess what the reporter talked about, the male reporter, I don't know what his name is.
It's Anthony.
Is right on target. The schools are desperately looking for some topical name that will sell. And the testing companies are looking to make a lot of money out of the schools. And that's what happens. The best thing that ever worked, and having taught over 500 children, essentially assisted them in their reading, was the follow-through program where an aide and extra people were in the classroom. And that came after Head Start. Of course, it was abolished long, long ago. And it's mentoring and having extra people in the classroom, and that's what parents need to do. If you want to get involved politically, that's fine. But if you want to assist your very own child in their class, go into the classroom and make yourself a part of the curriculum.
And Evie, as someone who has spent so much time in education, what are your thoughts on the Gates Foundation and the role
I'm
that
horrified.
They're playing in education?
I'm horrified. It's like walking in with clunky boots into a pristine area and waiting for the destruction to happen and then coming in and fixing it. That's the take I get on what they're doing. Why wait until the destruction to give the money? Why not change the policies of the corporations that are making the mess?
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Evie. We'll get a comment in just a few minutes. I want to take a few more calls. Let's hear from Molly in Monterey. Hi, Molly.
Hi. This is such a broad issue that my little bumper sticker thought is privatization is theft because it's no longer serving the public interest. In this case, when the Gates Foundation started giving computers to schools, school children in Africa, it's marketing. It's marketing, and I don't know, I just think that becomes an enormous problem. I appreciate how hard the people you're talking to are working on this issue.
Well, thank you for calling. I mean, that raises another question about how you keep up with all of this, because this Patch article I referred to earlier out of West Roxbury by David Erdeshek focuses on everything from the Gates Foundation investing in the Small Schools Initiative in Boston Public Schools, $13 million. And according to this piece, that program exploded and then there was no money left to clean up the mess. You spoke earlier, Anthony, about charter schools. They're also involved in this organization, Stand for Children. Since 2009, they gave $12 million to Wendy Kopp's Teach for America. They're involved in teacher evaluation. Again, a lot of media grants. And then there's this database called In Bloom. And according to this Patch, again, the Gates Foundation spent $100 million on In Bloom. It is a database that collects every bit of student data, including scores, discipline records, special education status, personal interests, to create targeted worksheets to market directly to parents. I mean, how do you keep up with this, Anthony?
Well, it's like anything. Once you get immersed in it, it comes to you bit by bit, and you start to make a picture out of it. What you're talking about within Bloom fits into this pattern. In order to have a nationally standardized system, you have to have a national data system that communicates across the nation. In order to compare schools from one state to another, teachers from one state to another, you have to have all of this data in this big data system. Now, if you have an attitude towards data systems that says those are helpful, and obviously Bill Gates sees data systems as hugely helpful for reengineering the education system, then you're going to put a huge emphasis on that. If, on the other hand, you think that human beings are the key and that we need to empower individual teachers and students to be creative, then you're going to take a completely different tack. And when you listen to him talk about education, what he talks about is the fact that we have too many bad teachers, that we have that we're spending too much on education, and that we're not getting enough results. And so instead of investing more in programs like the reading specialist mentioned, he thinks that it's wasteful to have small class sizes. We should have larger class sizes in the classes of the teachers that get the best test scores. We should videotape the teachers who get the best test scores, and we should have teachers watch those videos and follow the scripts that those teachers create so that they can replicate those successful results. And for me, as a teacher, as a longtime teacher, I found that the life of my classroom revolved around the creative interactions that I had with my students. And that really depended on their autonomy and my autonomy, my freedom to focus on things that I saw were really interesting and take deep inquiry with them, go into deep inquiry with them into subjects that are interesting. If I, as a teacher, have to follow a very scripted curriculum and have to prepare for tests that are ever more frequent, then and have ever more consequences for me and for my students, then I'm really lost. I've lost the autonomy that makes me an effective teacher.
And again, this in Bloom database is also, it's a project with Amazon.com's Jeff Bezos, who now owns the Washington Post, and Pearson Education, which is owned by Fox News' Rupert Murdoch. And according to this piece, the database has been launched in 8 states. There's no opt-out policy, and eventually these states will pay $2 to $5 per student per record. Is this going to launch in all 50 states?
Well, they're trying to launch it. It is getting some pushback, and you know, there's a big opt-out movement around the country for that parents are organizing that are pushing back against standardized tests as well as these data systems. So people should look up. There's a group called United Opt Out that's working on this. There are other local groups that are encouraging and help giving parents information about what their rights are in terms of opting out.
Jennifer, I mean, when you look at like a database like this with Jeff Bezos, Rupert Murdoch, Bill Gates involved, how is this all affecting the debate we're having about education at a time when schools across the country are just hurting and then tuition, you know, at community colleges here in California is on the rise? It's hard for a lot of kids to even afford community colleges these days.
That's right. And I think what Anthony said about the sort of assumptions that go into that kind of database system apply in higher ed, too. I mean, one of the Gates Foundation's big pushes in higher ed was to create a grant maker called Next Generation Learning Challenges, which was explicitly set up to, with the higher education technology group called EDUCAUSE, to look at how education technology could be leveraged in the interest of improving graduation rates and providing education more cheaply. But interestingly, after the Gates Foundation awarded some $51 million to this grant maker, they didn't step out. They remained very much involved with 5 other sort of grant givers, all of whom were recipients of Gates money themselves, and 4 of whom had 1 vote each, whereas Gates and EDUCAUSE maintained 2 votes each in deciding exactly who would receive the grant money.
And that is Jennifer Ruark. She's deputy managing editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education. Anthony Cody, longtime educator. He writes the Living in Dialogue blog on Education Week's website. And we've got about 7 or so minutes left. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann.
Hi there. I was wondering if either guest could comment on how the Common Core Standards is going to dovetail at all with the IDEA Act, which is the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act that was signed a long time ago. It's a federal act so that people with special needs will get, you know, equal treatment in the schools. And I'm wondering if it's any way it's been addressed in the Common Core Standards, or are people with students with disabilities and special needs going to get left in the dust?
Thank you. Anthony, do you know?
Well, I'm not sure about the specifics related to the IDEA Act, but students with disabilities are generally, the Department of Education is pushing for them to continue to take the tests. They perform very poorly in New York State. I believe only 5% of the students with the disability rated as proficient on the Common Core tests. And this is one of the issues with Common Core, as well as it was with No Child Left Behind, that all these accountability mechanisms do not recognize the issues that schools have in teaching students with disabilities, students who are English learners, and those schools and teachers who have those students end up getting very poor evaluations and very poor ratings.
And overall, Anthony, how have all of these changes really affected students with disabilities?
What I have heard is mostly anecdotal of students with disabilities really struggling when they're given a standardized test. You know, they may have what's called an individualized education plan that spells out what's appropriate for them to be learning, where they should be challenged. But when it comes to times for the test, whatever their chronological age is, whatever grade they're in, that is the test that they're going to get. And oftentimes it's not at all appropriate. And so you hear stories of students who basically are barely literate being forced to spend long periods of time staring at a Scantron sheet while they're being forced to take a test that is totally inappropriate for them.
Jennifer, have your reporters looked into this issue?
Not at the K through 12 level, but that kind of one size fits all approach is really reflected in a lot of the Gates agenda on higher ed too. The Obama plan, which was announced about a month ago to tie student aid to college ratings, is concerning a lot of people. Under the plan, students attending institutions that got a higher rating could obtain larger Pell Grants and more affordable loans, but the ways in which the colleges would be rated are still in question. And some people are worried that the system would provide perverse incentives for institutions, for example, to discriminate against low-income or underprepared students because they wouldn't want their graduation rates to be affected.
Mm.
They are worried. There's some talk about colleges being rated based on what income their graduates make. Well, that risks penalizing institutions who graduate a lot of teachers or social workers who aren't going to make big bucks. So it really comes back to the question of what is the purpose of a college education? Is it to create, you know, citizens who will contribute to society? Is it to enable people to get high-paying jobs?
We actually did a show about that about a month or so ago. You just reminded me, there's a ProPublica investigation that we've been wanting to do on one of our Friday shows that found the portion of grants given to students is actually going to higher income brackets. So public mm-hmm. universities are shifting their aid, giving less to the poorest students and more to the wealthiest. Mm-hmm. And ProPublica looked at this over the last 6 years.
That's right. And in order to attract higher performing students, the colleges are giving this aid in the form of merit aid instead of aid for financially needy students.
All right. Well, thank you for calling, Ruthann. Another caller couldn't stay on the line but wanted to know if you can give us an example of a common core standard. So, for example, what do students need to achieve in, say, the sixth grade based on common core standards? Jennifer or Anthony, do you know? Can you give us an example?
Anthony?
Anthony? Did we just lose Anthony? We heard a pop. We'll try to get Anthony back. Jennifer, have you looked into this?
We really focus on college and universities, so we haven't looked at what sixth graders need to know.
Okay, well, hopefully we'll reconnect with Anthony and we'll get your question answered. In the meantime, let's hear from Andre in San Francisco. Hi, Andre. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Rose. Oh, and thank you so much for these wonderful things that you're all saying. I heard the word union mentioned once in connection with the charter schools. I'm wondering if your guest can comment on any kind of effects that these, like the Common Core, might have on teachers' unions or just on anything that they can foresee how it might affect the whole reputation of unions going forward.
All right. Well, thank you. In November 2011, the Gates Foundation gave a $376,000 grant to the American Legislative Exchange Council, which writes legislation that is introduced across the country, a lot of anti-union legislation in Wisconsin. Jennifer, can you take that one?
Well, that's really, again, more of a K through 12 issue, and I would definitely recommend that if readers want to know more about the relationship between the unions and the Gates Foundation, that they look at Education Week. And also, a journalist who did a couple of investigative pieces for Dissent magazine. If you come back to me in a couple minutes, I'll have her name at hand.
Okay. Anthony, Jennifer had a question about unions and where the Gates Foundation stands on unions.
Well, the Gates Foundation says that it's kind of agnostic about unions. Their main emphasis in funding has been to promote charter schools that are generally non-union. They also promote a lot of these groups that are active within unions or of teachers outside of unions that advocate for doing away with tenure or diminishing teachers' due process protections. Or evaluating teachers by test scores. Those are all things that really are harmful to the ability of unions to protect teachers in terms of their rights So on that basis, the Gates Foundation is hostile to unions.
All right. And that question actually came from Andre. We have just a couple minutes left. You know, what would you say to people who say the schools are strapped, the foundation has a ton of money, and, you know, they're pouring it into education? What's so wrong with that?
Well, it'd be fine for the, as Charles Piller mentioned, you know, their money would be welcome in education, but what they're trying to do is leverage their money and transform education into much more of a market-driven system. This takes education out of the realm of public control, and instead of having community-controlled schools that are controlled by elected school boards, we have schools that are in the private sector or semi-private charters that are controlled basically by small numbers of wealthy people.
And Jennifer?
Similar criticisms have been made in the higher ed realm. I mean, the Gates Foundation says, look, when you look at how much we have spent on higher education, and by the way, they're only 5 years into a 20-year plan for higher ed reform, it's a rounding error compared to the $150 billion a year that the federal government spends on student aid, for example, or the $70 billion a year that states spend. But an explicit part of their program is to leverage state and federal money. And critics are concerned that here is an enormously influential entity that's not accountable to voters and is not accountable even to shareholders.
And if I could just throw in one more issue.
We have about 10 seconds, Anthony.
Education Nation is coming up in a couple of weeks on NBC, and it has been funded by the Gates Foundation. It completely excludes a critical discussion of these issues of privatization or test challenges to Common Core or any of these other critical issues that we've been discussing.
Anthony Cody writes the Living in Dialogue blog on Education Week's website, and Jennifer Ruark is Deputy Managing Editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Who are San Francisco's movers and shakers? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about influential people and corporations in San Francisco. Today, the city is defined by its growing number of tech companies, but San Francisco is also home to major financial institutions and developers. So how do they influence the city's political and cultural landscape? And who's making important decisions about issues like development and the economy? Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Hello, this is Chuck Finney of Your Legal Rights. We're having a Call a Lawyer night this Wednesday evening starting at 7. If you have legal questions, we're off the air. Please call 1-800-525-9917. On the air, on Your Legal Rights, the topic will be workers' compensation law and issues. My guests will be certified specialists in workers' compensation law, Alice O'Sullivan, Lester Friedman, and Jason Marcus. That's this Wednesday evening at 7 for Call a Lawyer night and Your Legal Rights here at 91.7 KLW San Francisco.
Hello, I'm Chloe Tilley. Welcome to World Have Your Say, where we're focusing on the Kenyan shopping centre siege.
We have an idea who these people are, and they are clearly a multinational collection. And we also have an idea that this is not clearly a local event. We are fighting global terrorism here.
The Kenyan government says it now has control of all floors of a Nairobi shopping mall at the centre of a two-day siege. At least 62 people have been killed after militants from the Al-Shabaab movement began shooting and throwing grenades. Kenyans have come out in their thousands to donate blood. The hashtag #WeAreOne is being widely used, along with those who say it's not the action of a true Muslim under the hashtag #SomeoneTellAl-Shabaab. For the next hour, we're live in Nairobi speaking to eyewitnesses and hearing from Kenyans who say the warning signs were there for the authorities.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. Reports from the Kenyan capital Nairobi suggest that intense activity is still continuing at the Westgate shopping mall in the city, where a number of Islamist militants are still believed to be holed up. Within the last half hour, the Kenyan Interior Minister, Joseph Ole Lenku, told the BBC that operations would continue cautiously into the night. He said troops were in control of the whole building.
I want to confirm that we are now at the tail end of the problem. We will expect to have the process and operation continue over the night. Because of the very delicate nature of the operation, we continue to cautiously go about it. But going from where we stand and the grounds we have covered, we are convinced that we are at the tail end of the operation.
Earlier, Gabriel Gatehouse sent us this report from outside the shopping centre.
Well, you can hear some firing starting up again now. We're just going to take a little bit of cover behind this truck. There's been about an hour or so of lull during which that smoke has continued to rise, but a period of calm, and now suddenly this firing. We don't know what's going on inside, but certainly it sounds to me very much like that fire going into the shopping centre. The shooting seems to have calmed down a little bit for now, but we can still see some of those soldiers there in the distance. Certainly look like they're taking a covering position behind that wall.
A court in Egypt has banned the Muslim Brotherhood from carrying out any activity in the country and has ordered the confiscation of its assets. It's the latest measure to be brought against the group by the military-backed government. Quentin Somerville is in Cairo.
The ban goes much further than expected. It stops all activities of the Muslim Brotherhood, as well as freezing all of its assets. It's the latest attack against the group, which has seen a dramatic fall from grace. For a year, it ruled Egypt. Now, many of its leaders, including the ousted President Morsi, are in jail. Hundreds of Brotherhood supporters have been killed as the military-backed government sought to end protests in Cairo and elsewhere. The group says that the army's removal of President Morsi from power is nothing short of a military coup and continues to demand his reinstatement.
The Brotherhood reacted angrily to the latest move by the government. It described the measures as corrupt and politically motivated and said the Brotherhood would remain part of Egyptian society, even if it were dissolved. At least 14 people have been killed in Iraq in an attack on mourners in a funeral tent in the capital Baghdad. Many others were wounded. Reports suggest a car bomb went off near the tent and a suicide bomber blew himself up afterwards. You're listening to the latest world news from the BBC. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel says she's had an initial discussion with her main rivals, the Social Democrats, as she begins the task of forming a new coalition government after Sunday's general election. Andrea Nahles, the General Secretary of the centre-left SPD, said there was nothing automatic about a grand coalition. The party has bitter memories of its crushing 2009 election defeat after its junior role during Mrs. Merkel's first coalition government. The International Labour Organization says there's been a dramatic drop in the number of children involved in child labour. In its latest findings, the organization said numbers had fallen globally by almost 78 million over the last 4 years. Constance Thomas, director of the ILO's International Programme on the Elimination of Child Labour, said there was still a lot of work to be done.
For many countries, some of this progress is fragile. The last thing we want is the good news in this report to produce complacency and for countries to think, okay, the fight is done. There are still 168 million children in child labour.
Two seems
to think, okay, the fight is done. There are...